Welcome to another episode of The Watchdog with me, Loki. We are here on Mint Press weekly, producing work which challenges the elite narrative and the status quo in our public sphere. For that reason, we really hope that you can support us in whatever way you can. If you are able to like, share, and subscribe on this video, we would appreciate that. But also, please do support us on Patreon. We really do appreciate the support that we receive there. So we hope that you can contribute and allow us to continue doing this important journalism as a form of public service. So this week, we are joined by the enigmatic Alan McLeod, who has recently cracked 150K followers on Twitter and overtaken me, which I am absolutely gracefully bowing out to. I believe he deserves that for sure. How are you, Alan?
It's good to be with you, man. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. So we're here to speak about some of your recent stories. One of them was co-written with me. You have delved into some really interesting crevices of the infrastructures of power within our society. And I guess the first one to ask you about would be this story that we worked on together, Oracle and Larry Ellison. What could you tell us firstly about Oracle? What is it?
Yeah, it's one of the biggest names in tech, but unlike something like Facebook or Google or Microsoft, I think most people probably haven't even heard of the company Oracle or its founder, Larry Ellison, who's one of the richest men in the world. But it's actually one of the most important organizations that underpins today's modern high-tech economy. Oracle is named after Project Oracle, which was a CIA project that Larry Ellison worked on in the 1970s. The CIA was actually Oracle's first customer. What it does is it basically builds databases and cloud computing services and the physical hardware that actually keeps the internet afloat. So when you hear people say, oh, well, your data is stored in such and such cloud or whatever, it basically means it's in an Oracle facility somewhere in California or Utah or Israel or many other places around the world. And that is really what Oracle is all about. And really, ever since its beginning, and even before its beginning in the 1970s, it has been fundamentally intertwined with the U.S. national security state. It grew from a very small fledgling company into a multi-billion dollar behemoth that it is today. And it has done that through getting fat off of the huge contracts that Washington lays out to all sorts of companies, whether it's regards to defense or national interest more generally. So for instance, in 2020, Oracle signed a deal with the CIA, which was reportedly worth tens of billions of dollars to provide the agency with a massive cloud computing network. When you actually look at Oracle's board, they also have many connections to that particular agency as well. For instance, former CIA director Leon Panetta was announced as a member of Oracle's board in 2015. David Carney, who spent 32 years at the CIA, rising to become its third in command, also joined Oracle and heads up its information assurance center. And Oracle to this day aggressively and actively recruits current CIA analysts to join the private sector. But as we discuss in this article, this long investigation, it's not really technically the private sector. In fact, with so much in Silicon Valley, it's very difficult to see where the national security state ends and Silicon Valley begins.
Great. And what can you tell us about its founder, Larry Ellison? What's his story?
Larry Ellison is one of the richest men in the world. He also uses a lot of his money to promote causes that he's interested in. He also uses that money to try and influence governments. He has given all manner of prestigious jobs and grants to senior British political figures. I'm thinking, for example, Matthew Symonds, who is Boris Johnson, the former prime minister, his father-in-law. He earned over $600,000 per year as an executive director of Larry's foundation, the Larry Ellison Foundation. Also, the head of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, Richard Meredith, had a similar role. Ellison also bankrolled the Tony Blair Foundation, which is the pet project of the former Labour Prime Minister. Ellison is also deeply connected to the State of Israel. In fact, he is, I believe, the biggest donor on record to the Friends of the IDF. He has many friends among the Israeli political establishment, including Zippy Livni and also Benjamin Netanyahu, who he holidays with sometimes. And in fact, he offered Netanyahu a seat on Oracle's board. And if that surprises people, I don't think they've been paying enough attention to Oracle, because in fact, the head of Oracle, Safra Katz, has been very explicit in that she sees Oracle's mission as, one, providing services for the internet, but two, advancing the goals of the State of Israel. So one long quote that you found Katz talking about came in the context when she was asked about a lot of employees of Google who were speaking out against the company's fraternization with the Israeli government and helping them commit crimes against the Palestinians. When asked, she said, and I'm quoting now, "We are not flexible regarding our mission, and our commitment to Israel is second to none. This is a free world, and I love my employees. And if they don't agree with our mission to support the State of Israel, then maybe we aren't the right company for them. Larry and I are publicly committed to Israel and devote personal time to the country, and no one should be surprised by that." And so ultimately, I think that really goes straight to the heart of the matter. This is a company that is deeply enmeshed with the US national security state and also the unofficial 51st state of Israel.
Great. And I mean, also, Alan, an interesting thing that we haven't mentioned so far is that Larry Ellison lent Elon Musk $1 billion to buy Twitter with. And it was found that they were communicating back and forth about the acquiring of Twitter by Elon Musk. So again, that would cause some concern about how likely Elon Musk is to implement policies that protect the free speech of pro-Palestinian tweeters. But an interesting part of this story that I would just like to unpick a little bit more is this Larry Ellison Foundation, which not only was employing figures who were simultaneously working for the British government, employing Boris Johnson's father-in-law at the time when Boris Johnson was prime minister. And all of this was simultaneous, as far as I understand, to Oracle bidding for these contracts with the British government. If you could tell us a little bit about the contracts for the British government. I mean, some other people that were employed by Larry Ellison's foundation is a consultancy firm, which is literally right next door to the Conservative Party headquarters at Milbank. And the interesting thing is that pretty much as soon as Oracle was given these contracts with the British government that we're just going to talk about, it seemed that the charity, the Larry Ellison Foundation, shut down. So surely that would cast a question mark of what exactly was happening with these key figures in British government being employed by Larry Ellison at the time, at the same time that his company, Oracle, was vying for very important contracts from the British public sector.
Yeah, I mean, it does suggest a real dark corruption at the heart of British politics. And people have got to speak for themselves about this. So in 2020, Oracle won a gigantic contract with the UK's Ministry of Defence to provide it with all sorts of things: cloud infrastructure, digital assistance, data visualization software, all sorts of development tools as well. That's not the only institution that Oracle has worked with. It has big contracts with the Home Office, the Office of National Statistics, and the National Health Service, among many others. So that really means that Oracle is party to pretty much all of the most sensitive personal and military information that the United Kingdom has. And as you said, for years before signing these agreements, Ellison had been trying to ingratiate himself with the elite of the United Kingdom, both in the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. And as you said, almost as soon as he got these giant contracts, his foundation mysteriously closed down, which I believe was actually a surprise even to many of the people who worked for it. And so again, yeah, we do have to ask questions about what's going on here.
I mean, also the other thing is that Boris Johnson's father-in-law, who is ostensibly a journalist, had a relationship with Larry Ellison that went back a lot further than the foundation. He actually, the father of Carrie Symons, the wife of Boris Johnson, wrote this book, which was like a sort of a propaganda piece for Larry Ellison several decades ago. So it's quite an interesting connection there, of course. And I guess the question would be, is that if you are the Ministry of Defence, how are you supposed to keep your information secure? I mean, of course, the United States has whatever it wants in this country. It's got 12,000 soldiers based here. And Britain very much functions as a sort of a poodle to the United States generally on the world stage. But surely there's a question about whether a company that wanted to appoint Netanyahu as its director, what would it be doing with that kind of level of access to British military secrets as well as Home Office secrets and NHS data? I mean, it really boggles the mind when you think about it, Alan. What do you make of that? Do you think that is a wise thing when it comes to national sovereignty?
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, I guess it is a question of national security and national sovereignty that this sort of ultra-sensitive data is being essentially given out to a company which has such deep ties both to the American national security state and the Israeli national security state. If a country wants to have an independent foreign policy or an independent stance on things, this is not the sort of thing that we can just be outsourcing to. For centuries, governments have understood that key industries have to be controlled in national hands. For instance, like energy production, food production, things that are really basic and core fundamentals to a functioning society. And in the 21st century, ultimately, we are talking about communications and telecommunications being absolutely crucial, not only to the functioning of society, but also to the economy. And so I think not just Great Britain, but any country really has to take these sorts of questions very seriously. And I don't see many doing this worldwide. I think really, when it comes down to it, there's only a few that are really doing this. China is one of them that has really put up the big firewalls against the encroachment of Silicon Valley into everything online. But apart from that, I don't really see many European countries following suit.
In a way, I guess it's a problem of neoliberalism, where all of the government functions generally are being outsourced to private companies. And as you mentioned before, there's an impetus for people within the public institutions to actually go on and work for private companies, procuring contracts from their former employee because they end up getting paid more. And then when it is a case of outsourcing, if you're outsourcing things like data management, which is the cloud infrastructure stuff, to a private company, then it opens up all types of questions about what that private company might do with your data. So for the next part of the podcast, Alan, I wanted to talk to you about another study that you have recently put out for Mint Press. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about this Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University.
Sure. Georgetown University, for people who are not in the know, is right at the heart of Washington, D.C. And I mean that both geographically and figuratively. The Walsh School of Foreign Service isn't a particularly big school within Georgetown University. I think, if I'm right, there were 377 graduates in the academic year of 2021, most of them pursuing courses in things like security studies, foreign service, or Arab, Asian, or Latin American studies. But the reason it's important and interesting to know about is that this is not only the number one pool of recruitment for the CIA, it's also the CIA is also the number one employer for the School of Foreign Services. Not only that, it's just completely open that this is basically CIAU, where young people from all across America and indeed the world come to get trained in the dark arts of spycraft. Now, they frame it as being about foreign service, but actually the line between diplomat and spy or, you know, spook analyst is actually quite diaphanous nowadays. At the School of Foreign Service, which again, I said, it's not a particularly big school, I was able to find 25 employees who were openly stating that they used to be CIA analysts or CIA operatives of one kind and another. And that really means that what's happening now is that the old generation of spooks are being employed to train the new generation up. And if you do go to Georgetown, you're essentially getting an unofficial vetting from your professors, who will then suggest certain people go into certain lines, or maybe tell their ex-bosses at the CIA, no, don't employ this kind of person. And this has been going on for absolutely generations. Richard Nixon used to complain, for instance, about Henry Kissinger and his Georgetown set, because Kissinger would just go back to his old alma mater and just hoover up all of these new recruits and put them into positions in the State Department, where they would essentially do his bidding. So this has been going on for a very long time. And the reason why this is notable is that the CIA has really been at the heart of many of the worst atrocities of the 20th and 21st century. The CIA has been involved in drug running, smuggling guns, overthrowing foreign leaders, planting false information into the press, assassinating foreign dignitaries. The list of things that it has been involved in just goes on and on. For instance, just to pick one off the top of my head, Operation Cyclone in the 1980s saw the CIA go to Afghanistan and train the Mujahideen and arm them against the Soviets. And the blowback of that wasn't just for the Afghan people who were forced to suffer the rule of these people. It also blew back on the people of New York in 2001, because one of the people the CIA had trained and supported was Osama bin Laden, who carried out the terrorist attacks on September 11th. And so ultimately, these sorts of crazy projects that the CIA are involved in don't just hurt people in other countries, they also come back to bite Americans in the behind as well.
And also, Alan, can you just confirm, did the CIA actually fund the Walsh School of Foreign Service?
Yeah, that's right. I believe there was a study in 2011, actually published in Georgetown's own newspaper by the journalist Will Sommer. He revealed that the agency, which was based just over the water in Langley, had actually quietly donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to the School of Foreign Service to fund the department's work and fund certain academics' work specifically. And that is despite the fact that Georgetown University insisted on its website that the money came from anonymous donations from individuals. Well, it might have been anonymous, but it wasn't exactly from an individual. It was from a very well-known organization, which again really starts to underline the point that there's not really a sort of a nice juncture between state and private here. We do have a situation where the national security state is also kind of seeping into the world of education too.
And what could you tell us about someone we've already mentioned today, Leon Panetta? What's his perspective on Georgetown as an institution?
Yeah, so Leon Panetta, as I said, is a board member of Oracle. He was also former Secretary of Defense and former head of the CIA under, I believe, under President Obama. He absolutely loves Georgetown University. He's been there to give speeches about, you know, the CIA and their long-term commitment to, you know, keeping this partnership with the university going. He described it in a speech he made there as a leadership in the study of global security. In fact, he turned his speech there into a bit of a recruitment drive. He said that he was so pleased that, you know, there are so many incredible and charismatic young people coming through the School of Foreign Services. He said, and I quote, "Talented young individuals who have been at my side every day for the last 4 years, both at the CIA and at the Pentagon. And I'm deeply grateful for their work on behalf of me and on behalf of the nation. And I'm deeply grateful to Georgetown for training such extraordinary public servants."
Talented young individuals who have been at my side every day for the last 4 years at both the CIA and the Pentagon. And I am deeply grateful for their work on behalf of me and on behalf of the nation. And I'm deeply grateful to Georgetown for training such extraordinary public servants.
And so, yeah, Panetta, as head of the CIA, is in a position to really affect the agency and affects the government more generally. And he sees Georgetown and specifically the School of Foreign Services as an absolutely crucial cog in the machinery of the U.S. national security state.
And Alan, how would you think this would interact with some of the issues around quote-unquote Gen Z and military recruitment? What is the status of the current generations of young people and their involvement in the US military more generally?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, that is really the point of this school within Georgetown University, is to train the next generation of Mandarins who will carry out what is ever needed of them from a US empire perspective. But there was a recent report in the Washington Post which suggested that it might not be plain sailing for the US come 2020s and 2030s. And the folks over at the Department of Defense and the various branches of the US military are really deeply concerned right now, because a new study came out that said that only 9% of Generation Z, and they defined that as people aged 17 to 24, only 9% of Americans fitting that age bracket were willing to join the US military. And what that means in practice is that in the coming years, the US military is looking to have a huge shortfall in soldiers. For instance, in the last year that they've released figures anyway, the Army suggested that it was 25% down on its recruitment target. It was looking to hire 60,000 new active duty service members for the Army alone, and it was down by more than 15,000. And there were similar, if not quite as drastic, shortfalls with the Navy and the Air Force as well. And so ultimately, it does look like Generation Z just really, despite the fact that they are looking at a depressed jobs market, a much more difficult economic climate in general, seems to be absolutely against going to war and joining these and joining the US empire. So I think, you know, the kids are all right, is what I'd say.
You know, despite all of the indoctrination through things like Call of Duty, which you have previously looked into. So, Alan, just before we finish, there's a channel which has received a lot of attention in the recent period with unrest in Iran. That channel is, of course, Iran International. And I guess the big controversy around the channel is whether it is or isn't funded by the Saudi government. Can you help us clear that up a bit?
Well, if you're Iranian or if you're interested in Iranian politics or issues more generally, you must have seen Iran International. Since 2017, it's really burst onto the scene. It's a very high quality product. It's generated a big audience. It's got a very glitzy feel to it, very high production values, this TV network and website. It broadcasts in English and in Farsi, the language of Iran. It has boosted its credibility by poaching some of the biggest news stars in the Middle East, reportedly offering them two times the salary they were on at places like the BBC or Voice of America. So it's clearly a big money production. And it's also a very influential channel. There was one study that suggested that it is now the most influential, most trusted, and most watched network in Iran and around the Iranian diaspora. And if you look at the content of it, it really gives it gives a voice to Iranian dissidents anywhere. It hammers the Iranian government on LGBT issues or women's rights, anything that they can, really think that is an important topic to cover. There is one problem, of course. It appears to be funded by Saudi Arabia, and in fact, by Mohammed bin Salman himself, who is reportedly the driving force behind Iran International to begin with. And that's according to a 2018 Guardian report that was based on multiple interviews with former employees, many of whom were very jaded because they were told that there wasn't even a single cent of Saudi money in this operation, struggling to think of a comparative example in the West. But I mean, I guess just imagine if a new TV station took America by storm and it, you know, confidently stripped out Fox News for ratings or whatever. It was a very high budget thing. And then only later it was found out that, say, ISIS was behind it all. I mean, it beggars belief that this is going on. But that is apparently what is going on here with Iran International. I did speak to a member of the board of Iran International, and he did say that he rejected the claim that the Saudis were behind the operation. But unfortunately, over the past couple of weeks with this Saudi-Iran detente, which is going on right now, which appears to be mostly brokered by China, which is a very interesting aspect to it, that it's not going on with US auspices, that it's actually China doing this. There's been a lot of reporting in the Western press that as part of the deal that Iran and Saudi Arabia signed, that Saudi Arabia agreed that it would shut down negative coverage of Iran on Iran International. For instance, the Wall Street Journal reported that the Saudis agreed to tone down critical coverage of Iran on Iran International, which surely suggests that perhaps this Guardian report was actually more truthful than false, as Iran International would have you believe. Now, one of the reasons why this is important is that Iran International played a really crucial role in the 2022 protests that rocked that country from September onwards. You may remember a 22-year-old woman, Mahsa Amini, died in police custody, and her death, her suspicious death, really ignited nationwide protests. And one of the reasons they were really ignited is that channels like Iran International constantly told their viewers that Amini was murdered, that she didn't die in police custody. In fact, they would use terms like murder constantly, even in headlines. And even when certain information came out that suggested that that actually wasn't the correct framing at all. And so Iran International's coverage really helped spark a nationwide rebellion going on over there, which suggests that maybe their intentions might not have been completely above board, and maybe this is some sort of operation to try and destabilize the Iranian government. It's also given a platform to a lot of quite controversial figures and groups. For instance, the MEK, which is an armed paramilitary group and political group that until quite recently was on the terrorist list of the United States and the EU. It also, just a few weeks ago, had a great interview with Benjamin Netanyahu, where it really presented the Israeli prime minister as some sort of savior of the people of Iran. They were throwing him all sorts of super softball questions like, you know, do you have many Farsi or Iranian friends and what's your favorite Iranian meal, etc. And they were presenting them as like the voice of liberation across the Middle East. So I was left really scratching my head thinking, who is this channel for? Because I'm not really sure if it's really got its act together in terms of who it really represents. And that's one of the many, many questions that we have to ask ourselves with this big network that's come along, whose source of funding remains quite murky, to say the least.
Wow, Alan, thank you so much for that deep dive, full of information and nuggets for people to look into more themselves. Alan McLeod, you can check him out on Mint Press and, of course, on Twitter, regularly publishing very, very important information that you should know. This is Low Key. Hopefully you will join us next time on The Watchdog.